From the state capitol, the Florida Public Radio Network brings you Capitol Report.
School superintendents say the new way of rating Florida's public schools is unfair.
But the fact still remains that kids in poverty and our English language learners, our minorities, our students with disabilities do not perform as well as other students in school systems.
Supporters of privatized Florida prisons say everything is in the open.
For anybody who suggests that there's a bunch of secrecy going on and these bills aren't being heard appropriately, I challenge that.
Florida's top energy officer asks lawmakers to drop renewable energy mandates for utility companies. And lawmakers learned today the state's empty sports facilities are required to double as homeless shelters. I'm Tramell Gomes, and that's all coming up on Capitol Report. The Florida Department of Education has released a new ranking scale that rates school districts from highest to lowest. Lynn Hatter reports the rankings are coming under fire from school district superintendents who say it's not a fair way to look at how well students are doing.
3 years ago, the Jefferson County School District was bankrupt and paychecks for teachers were bouncing. It was labeled as a failing district, according to the state, and its school officials watched as many students jumped across county lines to Leonda and Wakulla, both A-rated school systems. But in 2 years, Jefferson managed to pull itself out of its financial and academic rut. It no longer has a deficit, and the system has gone from an F to a C. Jefferson Superintendent Bill Brumfield says the district has worked hard to shed its failing school image, and it's come a long way.
We have bright kids. Like I said, we'd had three children last week got accepted, three seniors got accepted at FSU. And you only got 50 seniors, that's pretty good, you know, that we've had those come in. But we are working hard here. We've gone from an F district to a C district, and we're going to be a B district next year. Our school's going to be a B. And, you know, and we're working very, very hard if people would just give us a chance.
The Jefferson school system shed teachers, switched around principals, and even established special science and technology-based career academies at its schools. Students are now graduating with nursing and engineering-based certifications so they can go straight into the workforce. But you wouldn't know all that by looking at the state's newest way of ranking schools. The Florida Department of Education has released a scorecard that lists districts from highest to lowest based on the standardized FCAT test. In Jefferson, despite its struggle, finds itself second to last out of 67 districts in the state. Brumfield says that's a blow.
It's really going to hurt the smaller districts. You know, and I will say this, I've talked to one individual in the DOE that agrees with me, and they think it's very unfair the way that we're treated to smaller districts.
And that's the problem that many superintendents and education officials have with the state's newest scorecard. At the bottom of the list, along with Jefferson County, is Madison, Gadsden, Hendry, DeSoto, and Hamilton. All of those counties are rural, all of them are small, and the majority of them teach a largely poor, disabled, and or minority student population, also known as subgroups.
And I know that people don't want to address it all the time, especially in Tallahassee, because it's a nationwide concern.
That's Okaloosa School Superintendent Alexis Tibbetts, the incoming president of the Florida Association of District School Superintendents. Okaloosa is an A-rated district according to the state, and it's at number 6 on the state's ranking list. But Tibbetts says these four groups of students are also the lowest academic performers, not only in Florida, but across the nation.
School districts that have fewer of those subgroups tend to perform higher. Now, that's not an excuse. But the fact still remains that kids in poverty and our English language learners, our minorities, our students with disabilities do not perform as well as other students in school systems.
What I'd hate to do is people to try to use poverty and socioeconomic status alone as a factor of why these children can't achieve. That would go against over 10 years' worth of work that Florida has put in place to make sure we take our subgroups and move them higher.
Florida Department of Education Commissioner Gerard Robinson defends the state's new ranking system. He says while the correlations between low socioeconomic status and the rankings does exist, it shouldn't be the only thing that people look at when breaking down the numbers. He says the goal is to spark a conversation on how to make schools better and open up the information to larger audiences.
You can always have more dialogue and better informed dialogue. For example, while we all know the districts that have A's, we now have identified 30 districts minimum with A's, and now we've actually had a chance to see who's the fifth A versus the sixth A part of the dialogue. Number two, I can tell you there are actually some phone calls I received from people who said, you know what, I didn't know that my district A had this grade, or B, I was unaware of where the district ranked compared to others.
Robinson says the department used existing data that was already available and simply put it into an easy-to-read format. In release, Governor Rick Scott says the new list allows taxpayers to see their investment in education at work. Districts with national notoriety like Hillsborough County, which was the recipient of a major education grant a few years ago and often highlighted as the state's testing ground for education reform, is at 38 on the list. Dade County, known for its work with Hispanic students and English language learners, is in the number 37 spot. And St. John's, the county directly south of Duval, grabs the number one position. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
A massive prison privatization effort is causing quite a stir among Florida lawmakers. That's due to a move by Senate President Mike Haridopoulos to vet a pair of prison privatization bills through two committees that are not related to criminal justice. As Sasha Cordner reports, the bills now move on to one last committee stop, despite objections from some who feel the process is a sham.
The prison privatization bills are one that would privatize about 30 South Florida prisons, and the other allows any state agency to sign a contract with a private vendor without providing any analysis on the effects of the privatization effort. Both bills have the strong backing of Florida Senate President Mike Haridopoulos. Last week, he sent a memo saying he thought the measures had gotten plenty of legislative scrutiny last year. Still, he was willing to, in his words, quote, proceed with an abundance of caution and refer the bills to two committees for more consideration this year. The Senate Rules Committee is chaired by Republican Senator John Thrasher, whose committee originally filed the bills. The Senate Budget Committee is headed by J.D. Alexander, also a strong prison privatization backer. However, not everyone likes where all this seems to be headed.
It should have gone to at least two, probably three committees through the process, like all of the bills that are filed during session go through.
Republican Senator Mike Fasano is head of the Senate committee that oversees the Criminal Justice Committee. He had actually sent a letter to Senate President Mike Haridopoulos before the memo was issued to make sure the bills were vetted through the proper committees like his own. He says what the Florida Senate is doing now is just plain wrong.
Extremely disappointed, as I believe some other members are. This is a way, unfortunately, that leadership is circumventing their own rules. You know, the Senate is a unique place, the Florida Senate, where we follow procedure, we follow policy, and to all of a sudden change the rules in the middle of the game, I think gives a bad mark and a black mark on the Senate right now.
And there were still other lawmakers like Senator Dennis Jones who had reservations as well, who were on Monday Senate Rules Committee.
I haven't heard anything in this testimony today that would assure me that we would not be reducing the level of competency in public safety. And from that standpoint, I am not willing to try and balance the state budget on the backs of law enforcement or public safety at this time.
His thoughts came after hearing hours of public testimony of those in opposition to privatizing the South Florida region, including correctional officer at Santa Rosa Correctional Institution, Brett Pruitt.
What we've got to remember is that corrections is a law enforcement function. Once you start privatizing law enforcement functions, you open the door for everything else. And I always ask, what's next? Is Walmart going to be writing us traffic tickets?
Also there was former state Senator Ron Silver, an attorney with the Teamsters Union, which represents thousands of correctional officers. He says there's nothing that shows that how the state prisons are run now is not working, so he does not understand this sudden push to privatize.
When you privatize these prisons, there's no assurance that you're going to have the same safety standards as you have right now. So that's why I don't think that this is a good bill. And the savings that they say they might be able to save is questionable. Some reports say, yes, there is savings. Some say no, and it's all how you determine it. So, you know, What are we doing? I don't understand it. Because when I was in the legislature for 24 years, we never, you know, had anything like we're seeing here today.
Someone who also felt the same way is Matt Puggett, the executive director of the Florida Police Benevolent Association. That's the group that had sued to block the prison privatization plan last year. The association had won the challenge by a judge who said the legislature could not put a provision into the budget to privatize prisons without a bill. But the matter is now under appeal. Still, that did not stop the Senate from filing the bills, which Puggett says is typical of this chamber.
There's an independent streak in that Senate, and I think if we look at it on face value, again, we're asking taxpayers to forget everything we did 6 years ago, and we're going to allow the legislature to privatize however they want and prove it afterwards. And we're using faulty numbers to outsource 18 counties worth of correctional facilities.
Still, chairman of the Rules Committee, Senator John Thrasher, defended the Senate's position.
For anybody who suggests that there's a bunch of secrecy going on and these bills aren't being heard appropriately, I challenge that.
And Senate Budget Chief J.D. Alexander says going ahead with the prison privatization effort is a must for the state.
I think this holds the possibility of saving from $22 to $45 million annually. You know, these are real dollars, and these are difficult decisions. I don't know that they are easy, but if we don't save them here, then those are dollars that we don't have to meet the other needs of our state, from our K-12 system to our folks with disabilities to foster kids and et cetera. So.
The Senate Rules Committee voted both measures favorably, and they now move on to the Senate Budget Committee and will be taken up on Wednesday. The House Justice Appropriations recently filed its own prison privatization bill that differs a little from the Senate proposal. It would privatize the same correctional facilities in the South Florida region with the exception of one. It also has a stipulation that correctional employees affected by the prison privatization effort must be given first preference for employment by the private prison management company. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida's top energy officer asks lawmakers to drop renewable energy mandates for the state's investor-owned utilities.
That's something that the legislature had put into statute several years ago. No action has been taken. We propose to remove it from the books.
A bill that would standardize the state's beekeeping laws could help Florida's fight against aggressive Africanized bees.
Those Africanized bees are out there. You cannot stop them. They're not going to go away.
And a Senate committee says empty sports facilities are required to provide shelter to the homeless.
If you went to the football fields or the baseball facilities, where do they put the homeless people and how do they do that? Are they really doing that?
Former Florida Governor Charlie Crist was a big fan of alternative and renewable energy. The state's commitment to developing those energy sources may have slipped a bit with his departure from the governor's mansion. But Tom Flanagan reports the concept remains very much alive at the state capitol.
Florida Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services Adam Putnam was front and center at Monday's meeting of the Senate Communications, Energy, and Public Utilities Committee.
We think that this is a good beginning. For you to chew on and mull over as you deliberate a potential energy package for this session.
As things stand now, Putnam is state government's top point man when it comes to such things. That's because last year, the legislature put Florida's energy office in the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services.
The first task was to sort out the pile of coat hangers that is the solar rebate program. And within 100 days, the energy office had done that. And those checks were issued to customers who had invested in that technology, and they got back roughly half of what at one point had been contemplated in that program.
Putnam says that program and federal stimulus incentives for renewable energy totaled some $200 million. Auditors are still trying to figure out how much of that money went where it was supposed to. But that's the past, Putnam says. The big issue now, he told committee members, is to diversify Florida's power production portfolio.
It's about 51 now. Within a decade, statewide, it'll be about 56. If you look at within utilities, it could be as high as 70% dependence on a single fuel source,
which is natural gas. It's cheap now, but Putnam cautions that can change in a hurry. So he'd like at least some of the existing incentives for utilities to bring more renewable energy online stay in place, as well as some new ones.
One recommendation is to require the PSC to place a value on diversity and consider that value during need determination proceedings. We think that by placing that value on diversity, we can improve the opportunity to strengthen our energy security and reduce our dependence on a single source.
Putnam says because of this and other factors, he's confident the state's investor-owned utilities will be eager to voluntarily make more of their electricity from things other than fossil fuels or nuclear power. As a result, he says the state can drop the old mandate pushed by Charlie Crist to require utilities produce at least 20% of their power from renewables by the year 2020.
That's something that the legislature had put into statute several years ago. No action has been taken. We propose to remove it from the books.
Putnam says utilities wouldn't have to worry about making huge upfront investments to go renewable.
They would be able, if they so choose, to do 1% or 75 megawatts, have some recovery when it is determined that that investment is in the public interest and that there is some economic limitation on that reduces and protects the interest of the ratepayer in making those decisions.
Putnam's suggestions seem to find favor among most committee members. Melbourne Republican Thad Altman hoped the state's energy future would have a place for non-utility power producers.
I love our big energy producers. They provide a very important service. They do so very efficiently. But I don't love them enough to support monopolies. You know, I'm an American. I believe in free enterprise and competition.
After the committee meeting, Putnam said he was encouraged by the members' positive response. He told reporters he was confident they'd come up with bills supporting his suggestions.
So it's a incentive piece that doesn't pick winners and losers. It's less regulation, and it's pushing the PSC toward a more balanced portfolio of sources of our energy in Florida,
while at the same time removing a renewable energy mandate that Florida's investor-owned utilities couldn't wait to be rid of. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Tom Flanagan.
You're listening to Capitol Report on the Florida Public Radio Network. I'm Tramell Gomes. Florida lawmakers are considering what some might call a sweet new bill. A measure aimed at unifying beekeeping rules is making its way through the legislature. Regan McCarthy fills us in on what the buzz is all about.
Honey production contributes as much as $15 million to Florida's economy every year. In fact, honey, pollination, and bees are a big industry in the state, and it's pretty heavily regulated by the state. But Senator Alan Hayes, who's sponsoring Senate Bill 1132, says individual communities are starting to pass their own ordinances, and some of those local laws really sting.
They're adding their own layer of regulations and red tape to an industry that's already struggling to survive, and it's vital to the food chain of our country.
Hayes, a Republican from Umatilla, says the ordinances don't generally stem from instances where someone has been stung or bee attacks.
These have been enacted as a knee-jerk reaction to some neighbors' complaint about hives in their area.
Hayes says his bill will create uniform beekeeping rules by giving the sole rights to overseeing beekeeping and hive locations to the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Nancy Gentry is with the Florida Honeybee Technical Council. Gentry says banning bees from specific areas can cause some sticky situations.
If you start banning bees in these urban residential areas, what's going to happen is you're creating an environmental void. In other words, you're giving the Africanized bee the opportunity to go into these areas without any competition at all. And we clearly state in the department all the time that the first line of defense against the Africanized bees are, you know, the European honeybees, which is what a beekeeper actually manages.
Gentry says European honeybees are actually relatively laid back. She says a person could make a bee mad by knocking on its hive, but even then it would only behave aggressively toward the person until he or she leaves the bee's territory, which is about 20 feet. That's compared with the Africanized bee.
The Africanized bee is still a defensive bee. However, their aggressive zone is much larger, which essentially is about the size, the width of a football field. Okay? They're going to get you if you're in that area. Mm. You get into that zone, they'll send out maybe 100 bees within a matter of seconds. They're sending out thousands.
Gentry says Africanized bees are making their way north from South Florida.
Those Africanized bees are out there. You cannot stop them. They're not going to go away. They are migrating northward, lining the sand probably about south of Atlanta. So really, it's Florida's responsibility to try and do as much as we can to slow it down, is what I'm trying to say.
Senator Larsenia Bullard, a Democrat from Miami, raised concerns about forcing local governments to allow hives in their communities.
We should have a guidelines in place and oversight, but I definitely believe that we need to be cautious and place an in language in statute that is a mandate rather than permissive language.
Hayes says the bill is not a mandate. It just says the Department of Agriculture will be the only agency that can make rules about beekeeping and where hives are or aren't allowed. Hayes and Gentry provided a few samples to sweeten the bill just a little more.
Enjoy the honey. I think if you get that little sugar rush, it feels good. You have no choice but to go unanimous on this bill.
Several senators took a taste, and the Agriculture Committee did pass the bill with a unanimous vote. The proposal now moves to the Senate Budget Committee. A similar bill is making its way through the House. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Here's Ronald J. Evan with a look at some of the action around the Capitol tomorrow.
Tuesday is Military Day in the Florida Senate with a National Guard display in front of the Senate office building. The House K-12 Innovation Subcommittee will consider the Parent Empowerment Bill. It concerns the rights of parents whose children are assigned to low-performing schools to be provided with a performance rating of the teachers. The bill also prohibits the consecutive assignment of students to underperforming teachers. Also before the subcommittee is a bill concerned with athletes and concussions. The bill requires an independent sanctioning board for youth athletic teams and high schools to adopt bylaws and policies relating to concussions and other head injuries. It requires a removal from practice and a written clearance to return. The House will be in session from 11 till 12:30, and that's the daybook for Tuesday, January 24th.
Finally, professional sports teams in Florida may have to return millions in tax money under a proposal now moving in the Florida legislature. James Call reports a Senate committee today voted in favor of a bill that would force teams such as the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Miami Marlins, and Orlando Magic to give money to the state if a homeless shelter has not been set up in the facility.
Lawmakers were caught by surprise when Bradenton Senator Mike Bennett told them about a law passed 24 years ago. Tucked inside an economic development bill passed in 1988 is a provision requiring sports facilities subsidized by the state to serve as shelters for the homeless. The novelty of the idea appears to dawn on Jacksonville Senator Stephen Wise when he questioned Bennett.
Are we really using the Amway Center in Orlando to have a homeless shelter in there? I mean, where would they? I mean, if you went to the football fields or the baseball facilities, where do they put the homeless people, and how do they do that? Are they really doing that?
Senator Bennett.
Thank you. It's an interesting law, isn't it?
Faced with a $1 billion budget shortfall that is forcing layoffs and cutbacks in almost every service the state provides, Senator Bennett is going after the subsidies teams use to pay for new and renovated arenas, stadiums, and fields. Bennett's bill directs the state's auditor general to verify that a homeless shelter has been operating at the sports facility. If not, the county and professional team would be required to return the money advanced to the team by the end of this year.
I think that the biggest hit would probably be the Marlins, which I think the Marlins got about a $32 million hickey out there. When I'm looking at trying to cut money from Medicaid, and I'm trying to cut money from education, and I'm trying to cut money for other things that are desperately needed, I think that they should be able to participate too. I want to give them a chance to do good.
Since 1988, when the sports facility homeless shelter law went on the books, Florida has provided teams with more than $271 million in tax credits. Jacksonville Senator Audrey Gibson wondered how a team could prove it is in compliance with the law.
I'm trying to understand, would that be a written agreement, or what's the proof that the franchise must show that it has adopted a homeless shelter or is working with homeless programs?
Mr. Chairman, the statute shows that they had to submit a homeless program to do it. And if they have not submitted that, then they are not in compliance.
The homeless provision is part of a plan that grants teams $166,000 a month in tax credits to renovate or build facilities. 10 baseball spring training camps and 8 professional sports teams have participated in the program. The homeless shelter provision of the bill has gone unnoticed until someone, he says an attorney friend, pointed it out to Bennett.
You look at the professional sports franchises, keep going back to the taxpayers of the people's state of Florida, and asking them for money, but they give nothing back. And it just kind of irritated me. And so I've been rallying against this for years. And lo and behold, somebody brought it to my attention that this statute had been put in 1988 and that they have chosen to ignore it. And so we looked at it and said, is there a way that we can enforce this law? And I think that the laws of the state of Florida are on the books for a specific reason, and they should be enforced.
Bennett also sponsored an amendment that would revoke most of the tax credits if the telecast of a home game is blacked out locally. The money would provide tickets to kids, combat veterans, and charitable organizations.
They'll still get a little tax break of around $41,000. But we think that there's a lot of deserving children out here who would like to go to those professional sports franchises and see those games. And since your taxpaying money is going to support this $166,000 that they each get a month, then I think it's fair that we have a lot of the children of those taxpaying people get to go to the game.
The proposal passed out of the committee with an 8-0 vote. It has 2 more committee stops. In the House, Miami Representative Frank Artiles has filed a companion bill. For Florida Public Radio, I'm James Call.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are James Call, Sasha Cordner, Tom Flanagan, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to the contributing stations along the Florida Public Radio Network. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance for Capitol Report, and I'm Tremel Gomes, inviting you to join us each weeknight for more reports from the state capitol.